Say you've written a murder mystery. You find an agent. You go to lunch. You talk about the business, not so much about literature. My guest today, Richard Curtis, is a literary agent. He seemed to be working against his own interests when in 1982 he wrote How to Be Your Own Literary Agent. He's once again revealing secrets of the business in his new book, Beyond the Bestseller, A Literary Agent Takes You Inside the Book Business. Curtis worked for many years writing almost any book he could get a contract for, from juvenile biographies to pornography. As an agent, he now represents many genre writers and includes Janet Daly, Steve Allen, and Leonard Maltin as clients. He also writes a monthly advice column for writers in the science fiction magazine, Locus. Curtis has watched as major upheavals have taken place in the publishing industry over the past decade, and since he began his career in the early 60s, the number of publishing houses has dwindled from around 75 to 20. Curtis believes as the conglomerates take over, the diversity of our literature is diminishing. He sees a system where the concerns are more financial than literary, a system geared towards star authors and bestsellers at the expense of finding new talent. The few hot authors are paid huge sums, while others are lucky to get a $5,000 advance.
What is stirring all that money up is the urgency, close to desperation, that publishers feel to get a book on the bestseller list to keep that cash flow going. Because many publishers are owned by conglomerates that own very profitable companies that make nuts and bolts type things that are used to seeing an annual growth rate of 15 or 20% or more.
So they expect this from their authors.
They expect this from publishers, and the publishers expect it from the authors. So there's tremendous pressure exerted on publishers and therefore on authors to produce and to produce whatever it was that did well last year or last book to do it again. And so either you go lusting after the author that is purported to be the hot new thing this year, or you put pressure on successful authors to repeat and formulaize their last successful book. But what you don't read about, and what I've tried to express in my book, is that the money, a lot of the money to acquire those star authors, comes off the backs of the little authors, who must struggle at pretty much the same advance price level that they have been earning for the last 10 or 20 years.
How have you, as an agent, tried to either exempt yourself from the cycle or continue to participate in it?
Well, I don't pretend to be a saint. My job is to make as much money for my clients as possible. And when I have a star author or an author that I think is going to be a star, I'm going to try to get as much money as the market will bear. But I, at the same time, feel that there are other values that must be considered when we look at the publishing industry. There are some agents who take the attitude that the publisher should be given enough of a break so that publishers can maintain their profit margin so that they can reinvest their profits, hopefully, in developing new authors. Unfortunately, that isn't always the case. What they do with the profits that they make from one star best-selling book is to go out and try to steal yet another star. And so the business has become more star-oriented and more formula-oriented.
Do you read all the manuscripts that come into you?
Well, we like most literary agencies, receive thousands of manuscripts a year. I read just about all of the manuscripts submitted by my professional clients, but when it comes to material submitted by new authors and would-be authors, sometimes you have to perform a kind of literary triage by glancing at material. If it's clearly terrible, then you have to reject it. If it's promising, then you have to take it home and read it, because there's really nobody else to do it for you. We can give it out to our staff, or we can hire readers to do it. But ultimately, when there is promising new material, we have to read it ourselves.
Part of your early career was as a freelance writer. How did you do as a freelance writer?
I did pretty well. I wrote just about anything and everything that sold when I was starting out as a writer. Everything from dirty books, I don't mind telling you, because in those days, dirty books were very mild and almost charming in their innocence. I wrote adult books. I wrote humor books. I wrote anything that that was for sale in the marketplace. I think I've had I've lost count, but about 50 books published, because I like many writers I know, work very fast. I can turn a novel in one draft in maybe 30 days. And many of the writers I know, and many of them that I represent, are capable of writing that fast as well. And so it's not surprising to me anyway, but it is to outsiders to learn that some authors have had 300 or 400 books published. And sometimes you don't even know their names, because so many of them have been done under pen names. And that was certainly the case with the work that I did. But it was a very good grounding for me to learn from when I became an agent. My grounding as a writer was very helpful to me in learning how to handle authors and how to speak to authors about their work. Many literary agents and many editors have never tried their hands at writing. And I've often joked that an editor or an agent should have to qualify for a license by writing a novel. Because then they would find out that many of the things that appear incredibly easy are incredibly hard, and vice versa.
But if you were able to churn out a book in, what was it, a week, you said?
No,
a weekend?
I know people who've written books in a weekend, but I would say...
That makes it sound incredibly easy.
I don't think it is not incredibly easy, but, you know, you can almost write in a trance. If you've plotted the book either on paper or in your head, and you set yourself a goal of 10 or 15, 20 manuscript pages a day, then in 15 or 20 days, you have a book-length manuscript. And many people don't have to revise. There is a whole world, what you might call a subculture, of writers who write popular literature, the kind of romances and science fiction, horror, the paperback originals, westerns, that really feed most of the reading habits of the public. And yet the public knows very little about them. They hear about the literary authors who have slaved and suffered over one book over a 10 or 15 year period. But there's a world of writers, freelance writers, many of whom who make excellent livings, who can perform what would appear to be miracles, and yet they take it as very commonplace.
Let's talk about genres for a second. There are genres in literature, mystery, science fiction, western. These rarely make the bestseller list, but they seem to make a substantial living income for the writers and the publishers and for yourself. What is the break-even point nowadays? How many books need to be sold in these genre categories?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to dispute something you said, which is that these books rarely go on the bestseller list. If you look at the bestseller list on any given week, you'll see that many, perhaps most, of the bestsellers are by authors who have emerged from the ranks of romance writers, horror writers, science fiction writers, westerns, like Louis L'Amour was a best-selling writer, Danielle Steele, Janet Daly come out of the romance field, Stephen King comes out of the horror field. One of the reasons I love genre writing is because it is a breeding ground for the people who tomorrow are going to be on the bestseller list. To return to your question, a modest sale for a paperback original in one of those categories, such as horror or science fiction or westerns, might be 25,000 to 50,000 copies sold. And then as authors become more and more popular, I would say a respectable sale, a sale where publishers begin to take notice and begin thinking of stealing authors from each other, might be around 100,000 copies sold of a paperback.
My guest today is literary agent Richard Curtis. One of the curious subgenres of writing is the novelization of a book that comes from a movie. And you are the agent for a book that was written by Peter Brian George called Red Alert that became Dr. Strangelove. I wonder if you could explain the convolutions that novelization went through.
Well, I worked at the Scott Meredith Literary Agency at the time it happened, and Peter George had written a very serious novel about what would happen if nuclear fail-safe safeguards failed, and we ended up with the nuclear missiles flying over the continents. A movie producer, it was published in New York, I believe, by Ace Books, a movie producer liked the book, thought it would make a dandy movie, and acquired it, and discovered that he really couldn't make much of a movie out of it, so he sold it to somebody who sold it to somebody who ended up selling it to Stanley Kubrick. And Kubrick saw the movie in it, but he saw it as this manic statement about the insanity of nuclear armaments, and he made this absolutely whacked out movie called Dr. Strangelove with Peter Sellers, I believe. The movie was so different from the original book that it was based on that they decided to have that book novelized and published as a new novel. Who did they choose to novelize it? The original author. So the original author ended up writing a novelization of his own novel. And it was published under a pen name, as I recall, by a different publisher. So you had really two books for the price of one, and based on, you know, that the book was acquired for the film and then novelized in a totally different way.
You also have worked as a novelizer. You made a novelization of John Carpenter's Halloween. What was different for you in doing that from writing one of your other books?
Well, most people think that novelizing, even writers, by the way, not just outsiders, but writers think that novelizing a movie must be very easy. All you do is take the screenplay and write he said and she said. And nothing could be further from the truth, because of the movies are seen with a different lobe of the brain than books are read. A short chapter in a book might expand into a 15-minute scene in a movie, whereas perhaps 10 chapters in a book might boil down to 10 seconds in a movie. And so the novelizing of films is an art form that I think is probably not very much appreciated. And I had to novelize Halloween, or Halloween 1, I guess, because there have been many sequels since then, but the original Halloween, and anyone who's seen it may remember that this was about, it starts, there's kind of a prologue about a little boy who sees his sister dressing or undressing for Halloween, and he goes into the kitchen, gets a long knife, and stabs her to death, and is then thrown in an insane asylum. And the movie proper begins about 20 years later, when he escapes from the insane asylum, goes back to the town he came from, and goes on a rampage. So I had to novelize this film, and it presented some very interesting challenges. For instance, this boy had been essentially locked away in an institution for some 20 years. But he escapes by car. And the question arose in my mind, and I knew it was going to arise in the minds of people reading the novel, how did he learn to drive when he was institutionalized for 20 years? So I had to make up this cock and bull story about how he'd become a trustee and had driven a truck around the grounds of the mental institution. nobody complained about it, so I guess they bought it.
Novelizers actually don't earn much money. They tend to get a flat fee, and in fact, you wrote a novelization for a horror movie called Squirm for a flat fee.
Yeah.
And then it went on to be a bestseller around the world?
Well, there was a horrible, really terrible, horrible horror movie made by a now defunct company about what happens when there's an electrical storm and a downed electrical wire stimulates worms to come out of the ground and terrorize a town. Everybody's fantasy of bloodworms crawling under your skin, and that's just what happened. And I was asked to novelize this film, and because it was such a dumb movie, and I knew I could make $2,500 fast in 10 days, when the publisher said, we don't want to pay you any royalties, I agreed to it. And so I wrote the book in about 10 days, and it did go on to be a very successful book. I believe it may still be in print in England and Japan and elsewhere, but I got my $2,500 and I've never seen another dime.
You needed an agent.
I did, but I don't trust agents.
My guest today is literary agent Richard Curtis. I see a number of nonfiction books that come in that just seem sloppy in many ways. A lot of extraneous information, not cleanly written, a lot of typographical errors, not even necessarily easy to read. What is happening to editors?
Well, they're owing to the takeover of publishing companies by other publishing companies and by conglomerates and entertainment complexes. What happens is that after a publisher is acquired, the efficiency experts usually say, well, what do we need two publishing companies bidding for the same kinds of stuff? So let's let go of some of our editors. And very often, good, competent editors are let go, particularly senior editors who come from an era when there was more, perhaps, pride and more time to work on a manuscript and perfect it. And so there has been, in my opinion, a decline. By the way, it's not only my opinion. I think it's generally accepted that the quality of editorial work performed on manuscripts has become far inferior to what it was 20 or 30 years ago.
This seems to work against the best interests of the book industry, because if books are more difficult to read or even unpleasant to read or a chore, why read a book when you can turn on the electronic TV?
Well, I think that's exactly what is happening. When people have a choice of being entertained in another medium, such as movies or television, if books are not any longer satisfying, or if they become so formalized as to become boring, then people will indeed turn to the many other media that offer more pleasure and possibly for the same amount of money or for none at all, such as television.
From time to time, I read in the newspaper that a major author has decided to switch publishing houses, and there's a great hue and cry about why so-and-so has abandoned one publisher for another. You were involved with some litigation with a former colleague of yours. You sued him for $1 million because he'd left and taken some of the authors of the firm with him to another place. What did you learn as an agent from that experience?
Well, you're talking about two different things. One is loyalty of authors to publishing companies. And I think probably, maybe I'm being nostalgic, but in a bygone era, maybe at least when I came into the business in the 1960s or so, you still had a very strong bond between author and editor, and that bond was paramount. The agent was not as powerful as agents are today, and so the main relationship was between author and editor. But as the business became more and more of a business, editors were either fired or they went lusting after new jobs, and so the editorial turnover reached a frenetic pace, and authors lost their editors sometimes. Every time they wrote a book, they lost their editors. And so the loyalty of authors towards their editors has weakened profoundly over the last few years. And what's taken its place has been a strengthening bond of author to the literary agent, because the agent is here. We were here yesterday and we're here today, and presumably we'll be here tomorrow to see the author through all these storms of editorial turnover. So there's been a growing loyalty from on the part of authors towards their agents, and the agents have therefore become even more powerful vis-a-vis the publishers. I did have an employee who represented some clients of the agency, and when he decided to set up for himself, he invited some of them to join him. And some of them did, and I felt it was a disloyal thing to do, and I reached for my lawyer.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you.